This is CD 10 of an 18 CD set containing sessions from a 4-week course by Ram Dass titled The Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. This CD contains part 1 of session number 10 titled Renunciation Purification 2.
Meister Eckhart said, "Whatever the way that leads you most frequently to awareness of God, follow that way. And if another way appears different from the first, and you quit the first and take the second, and the second works, it's all right. It would be nobler and better, however, to achieve rest and security through evenness by which one might take God and enjoy Him in any manner, in anything, and not have to delay and hunt around for your special way. That has been my joy. To this end, all kinds of activities may contribute and any work may be a help. But if it does not, let it go." It's a very relaxed strategy. From a practical point of view, we're faced with this interesting paradox that at one level of our intellectual understanding, we understand that we have all the riches. We have the Atman. We are the Brahman, we are the Buddha, we are not who we thought we were, we are free, we know all that. But if you look inside, you'll notice that somehow you don't believe it. And what all of the methods are about is getting you from where you seem to think you still are to where you don't think you are anywhere. Right? I mean, I'm just trying to stay within the framework of our structure. So that, granted that all methods, as we've talked before, are spiritual materialism, they are all within the framework of reality in which you think you are somebody who came to Naropa and has something to do. And were you able to just give up the whole framework, do it. That would simplify the whole matter considerably. On the other hand, if every time you try to do it, you get caught trying to do it, or if every time you do change your level of consciousness, you get dragged back in to another level, or if all of this, the lightness that appears in some beings who are free doesn't seem to apply to you, then you look around for methods to clean up your game, to get on with it. And they're methods in the old sense of you're doing something, you're doing this to get to that, even though you understand intellectually that's all a hype, that there's nothing to do. And you get into this peculiar paradox, there's nothing to do, so we can do it full time. Okay? I realize there's nothing to do, so I can sit here and hang out. Right? Because I don't think there's anything to do. I mean, I'm not doing it. This is just what's happening. Right? And if I get busy thinking I'm doing it, I better do my mantra harder, because I forgot. So that when we look at the Bhagavad Gita, we see that Krishna is talking to a very specific type of person. He's talking to Arjuna, who is a kshatriya, a warrior. He's talking to Arjuna, who is, in terms of the gunas, which we're going to be talking about tonight, the three threads or ropes of nature or manifest form. Arjuna is what would be called, he's dominantly rajasic, action, fire, doing, I am the doer. But he's also very sattvic, he's very pure. So he would be called rajaso sattvic, right? And for somebody who is rajaso sattvic, there is a certain path, which is the path of karma yoga and devotion. Krishna isn't really laying a heavy intellectual rap on Arjuna, okay, because that really isn't where his head is at. And in a way, what you have to do is to recognize your own unique predicament in terms of individual differences, and then start to find within that what your dharma is or what your path is. Trungpa's teachings, the category system, for example, are what are called the Buddha families. And as you study those, you begin to see the different characteristics of the Padma or the Vajra or the Buddha aspects, and you begin to recognize in yourself certain of these qualities. And those qualities help you define your own unique karmic predicament, which will help you in figuring out what your dharma is. There are all these different systems of individual differences, which I've briefly mentioned before, called the gunas. And you see the predicament. Now, here we are thinking we're trying to get enlightened, or thinking we are on a path. In that case, we are still identified with that of us which is in prakriti, or in nature. We are identified with the gunas. Later on, when we have finished with that elusive thought, when we've through meditation or whatever gotten rid of it, so that we're absolutely quiet, without any models, then all of our action and all of our form of manifestation will still be within the gunas and still be within our karmic uniqueness, but no longer will we be ruled by them. We will, in fact, be free of them, but we will function through them because it is our vehicle. It's like the more enlightened I get, I don't grow more hair in my head. You know, it's still going away, just going away. You know, maybe I'll get some yogic siddhi at some point that I can grow hair back. But no matter how conscious I get, then I'll be a conscious bald man instead of an unconscious bald man, right? In other words, I'll take what's given and work with it, but it'll be easier for me to work with it because I won't be stuck in it so deeply. And what you use these analysis of individual differences for, see, there are many levels of using all this stuff. You use them in order to get free of a lot of ways in which you've been holding on to who you think you are all the time. Because most of the way in which our egos are structured from inside out, from inside you out, are a lot of sort of half-cooked, half-conceptual, emotional kinds of models about who you aren't and what a jerk you are and how you're never going to make it and how ugly you are and, you know, all that stuff just lurking, sort of smoldering, you know, in a very unclean way, not dirty, but uncrisp. And a lot of times category systems help you get free of other systems you've been using that you're in so deep and they're such subtle habits that you can't get any leverage on them. So that in psychology, for example, you use the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. You know, and you get so that you look at everybody as a high PD or a hysteric or a MF or whatever it is, and you draw profiles of them, and, oh, I know who you are, you're a clear, you know, PD, blip, blip, you know. And it's all done in terms of psychodynamics, which is based on pathology. Like, nobody's really normal, it's all just how sick you are. It's the chart of how sick you are. There are other personality inventories that are more, perhaps, humane about humans. The Rorschach is a more subtle one. And each of those will give you a whole new take of yourself. Then you get to the astral plane, and of course you have your astral sign, and that gives you a whole other take. And it's incredible how much you clean up your game by knowing your astral configuration, which has as much scientific validity as any other system of individual differences. It is all relatively true. It's like Newtonian physics. It is true within a limited condition. Who you are is way beyond all these individual differences, but who you think you are is well within the individual differences. And you got to deal with where you start from, not where you're going to end up, no matter how much you'd like to. There's another system that is a familiar one to many of you, which is the chakras. That works within an energy framework. And the traditional seven chakras of the body, starting with the Muladhara, ending up with a Sahasrara, you can roughly psychologically equate these chakras with the first one, which is at the bottom, sort of halfway between the anal sphincter and the genitals, right in that area, is primarily connected with survival. The second chakra, which translates as her favorite resort, which is referring to the Kundalini as it comes up, and that's the sexual chakra, sort of like the Riviera. And the third chakra, which is around the midsection, could be thought of as connected with ego power, and the fourth chakra connected with compassion, the anahata, and the fifth chakra, the sutta, connected with turning inward towards God and with the voice and with divine sound coming through. And the sixth chakra, which is the ajna, which is up here, connected with the guru, the third eye, that whole realm. And the seventh chakra, the thousand petal lotus, is the merging into the Brahman, right? And if you are sophisticated in that, if you read John Woodruff and things like that, and you're sophisticated in the chakra systems, then you begin to assess your own predicament and you say, well, a lot of my energy is my fourth chakra's opening. See, I can work in the chakra systems a little bit, and so somebody comes to see me and I'm sitting there looking at them, and suddenly what I see is a chakra chart. And I see various chakras like sending out lights saying bzz, 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 like, you know, compassion, 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 lust, 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 you know, power, power, power. Or you look and suddenly the heart thing is nothing's coming through. You know, but the head is this like beam, it's like Zapsville, right? And you get so that you can look in chakra terms at yourself and others and say, well, the energy is coming here, but it's still pretty blocked there, and because it doesn't open nice and neat, like you finish with the first, now we'll go to the second, you finish with the second. Everybody's got a little of everything going. And part of what the whole process of meditating, when you do meditations with energy, is you meditate up in the higher parts of your body and you bring the energy up. There is another energy type of meditation where you meditate on your hara, or the place below your navel, which is focusing on where the locus of the energy center is in your body. And you start from where that is and you become identified with that, and then it moves. Then there are ways of working with energy. See, these are all methods we're talking about now. And the method of Kundalini Yoga, which works with breath control and prana, with energy systems, with pranic systems. And that is all done in order to move the energy to various chakras. Traveling, for example, as I was around the world with Swami Muktananda, who has this capacity to give Shaktipad, direct energy, I've sat in a room where suddenly somebody gets up and dances who didn't expect to dance. You know, a rotund gentleman in a dark blue serge suit in Melbourne, Australia, for example. And he gets up and starts to do incredible Indian dance, right? And the man next to him, who looks just like a professor with a tweed jacket and a pipe sitting out of his mouth, starts to do mudras. But exquisite, perfect mudras. But the look on his face is one of total perplexity. Okay? And so on. Somebody else is doing automatic breathing and bouncing across the floor. And the whole place begins to look like a back ward of a mental hospital. And Swami Muktananda is just sitting up there playing his ektara with his eyes closed. And what is happening is he's like a beam of energy. And he's activating the kundalini, the energy in people. It's called giving of Shakti. And what happens is the energy starts to come up in the person, and wherever a center is blocked, let's say it gets up to the second center and can't get any further, or the third center and can't get any further, it comes out in a certain behavioral manifestation. Or if a little of it gets blocked here and more gets there, it comes out in another one. And there's a ditto chart of the 26 manifestations or whatever it is, and they're all very straightforward. This one will get up and dance, that one will do breathing, this one will do that one will pass out, that one will whatever. And he passes out the sheets, you know. You can keep score of who's got which chakra things, eh? Now, what happens is the energy is hitting against it's like a water going up a tube, and then it gets to a crimp in the tube, and it's got to, because of the pressure, it's got to go out. And people working with energy attempt to open their chakras by forcing against that. Psychedelics does a similar process of forcing or overriding existing structures, because it's a fallacy to think of these chakras as physical things, even though it is the sushumna, or this thing which would seem to be like in the middle of the spinal column. It isn't really the hole in the middle of the spinal column. It's really an astral entity, the sushumna and the ida and pingala, the nerves that go down the spine. It's not nerves that you can, in anatomy, dissect. And when you're working within these energy systems, you might be given a certain mantra, a bij sound for opening a certain mantra. Ram, 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 ram. We'll work on a certain mantra, right? And you're given by a diagnostician a certain mantra or a certain visualization exercise, a certain, like in Tibetan work, a mandala to work with. Which level you hear them at makes a lot of difference as to how useful it will be to know all that stuff. If you recall the systems we've been talking about, I'm trying to keep it simple, you recall that we have the indriyas or senses, and then there's the manas or the lower mind, which is pretty much connected to these senses and sort of thought. Then right above that is this thing called the ahamkara, which is the ego constellation of associative thought. Then above this is a thing called the buddhi, which is on a pivot like, and that buddhi is like the higher intellect. It's not intellectual, it's the higher knower, if you will, K-N-O-W-E-R. And that can turn inward towards the Atman, or it can turn down out into the senses. And for most people, everything is sense and thought oriented, and they're just totally in the world. But as you get this higher wisdom we've been talking about, either through sneaking up through your lower manas, or through direct experience of the touching of the buddhi, which is called the soul, you begin to experience your connection to this Atman or this light or the Brahman or whatever, however you want to call it. And at that point, the buddhi tends to want to go up or in more, and there's a pull in you to start to get on with it. That's what you're doing at Naropa. I mean, you could be a lot of other places this summer. Whatever kind of crazy thing it is that got you to go through all you had to go through to get here, that's what I just talked about, right? That's it. Now, depending on how you hear your individual differences, if you hear them with your lower mind, you're like another psychologist, for example. And all you're doing is hearing an intellectual structure, and then you're going to try to analyze what ought I to do about it, and you'll try to do it intellectually. But the thing we talked about earlier, which was the development of intuition, that becomes the way in which you work with these individual different systems in order to figure out what your dharma is. You don't figure it out, you tend to sense it. I get very mystical, right? As long as you are caught very much in worldly stuff and you're just busy with your senses and desires and thoughts and am I going to make it and what do I do now, you can't really use any systems at all because they're just going to feed into your neurosis. They're just going to feed your anxiety and your fear. They're not going to help you a hell of a lot. You might as well forget it and go swimming, you know. See? So it turns out that you finally realize that you have to do a lot of purification first before you're quiet enough to be able to hear what the trip is about. Because I know that somebody will come in and ask me something and I'll tell them and they can't hear it because they're too busy thinking. You know, they can't hear it because they can't quiet down enough to hear it. So that a lot of what we turn out to have to do at the stage of the game where we think we are, right, is we just have to do what's called purification. And that's something that Arjuna already pretty much has out of the way, and that's why the Gita doesn't make such a big deal about it. Because Arjuna was already a very sattvic person. But we have to get sattvic. And I'll explain about the gunas in a second. But what I'm suggesting is that you can't expect, for example, you go to a Trungpa lecture and you will hear something coming out that is so light and airy and spacious and easy. But somehow between when he had it and when you get it, something went wrong, you know? Because you don't end up being as spacious and free and easy as he is saying it when you end up thinking about it. Because who's thinking about it is different than what it was that it was said through. Okay? So part of our process is to calm down enough to be able to receive the information. It's all available. There are no secrets in the game. Okay? People say, well, you're going to give it a mantra, don't tell anybody, as if we got all these secrets. You're joining the club now. You join the fraternity, like in the fraternity. I had a secret initiation at college when I joined the fraternity, and I was given a password and a secret handshake for about $500. The reason that mantras are given secretly is because at the level of flickery faith you are when you get a mantra, if you run it through a few cynical heads, you won't have anything left. See? You go home and you say to somebody who you've been living with, "Hey, I got this groovy mantra." And you say, it's like my name is Ram Dass. See, and Maharaji said, his name is Ram Dass. See, and Ram Dass is so euphonious, Ram Dass. And it came from the beyond, you know, it's who I'll be. And I take it and it's a sacred vessel. And I go home and pretty soon everybody's calling me Rammed Ass and Rum Dumb, you know. With great love, I mean, it's great love in a certain way, but they're not respecting, you know, and it's like, can I afford it, you know? Pretty soon I think, well, I'll just be Dick, you know, it's easier. Okay? Okay. Because you just don't want to, the image I never like is the one about pearls, and it's too ugly. But sometimes it's good to keep your mouth shut about what you're doing. Unless people, and the Gita reminds us that a couple of times, don't lay the trip on people that aren't ready to hear. The game is to become your trip so much that other people will just come at you, you know, let me in, you know, let me know how to say Ram Dass, you know. But you don't come lay your trip. Well, so when you start to purify, now you're purifying not because, see, the predicament, as I said before when I started talking about purification last time, every religion has at the base of it all these do's and don'ts, like take the Ten Commandments. Okay. I mean, you know, Moses is faced with a peculiar predicament. He goes up to the top of the mountain and he has a mystical experience. He comes into the presence of Krishna and the Brahman. It's not called that, it's called G.D. No, it's unnameable, which is a very reasonable name for it. I mean, it's in every religion you get the same trip if you just listen. And then each prophet historically brought back what was necessary for the game that he was playing or she was playing. And they, because what it is beyond concept. We struggled with trying to just define the Brahman for about two lectures before I gave up. Okay. And so what it is you bring back is what he had was he had this unruly mob of people who were worshiping this golden calf, and they were screwing up the scene and they weren't getting on to Palestine. Yeah. And he had to tighten up the game. So he came back with these tablets and he said, look, he said, don't screw around. So he said, I mean, literally, he said, you know, don't commit adultery, don't take the name of God in vain, you know, etc., etc. Honor thy father and thy mother, and so on. And it was like based on, and the way we got it, most of us, was don't do it or believe me, he's going to let you have it. See? It's like Big Daddy sitting up there with a strap. Like, I remember whenever I would do something bad, my mother would say, wait till your father gets home. See? And that used to do it, because he never hit me. The poor guy was very meek. She was the fierce one, but it was like, wait till your father gets home, you know? But at any rate, all that time, I was waiting for my father to get home to punish me. And it was like fear was the motivating factor in why I was following the Ten Commandments. Now, after a while, as you start to tune into this wisdom that Krishna was laying on Arjuna, you begin to re-perceive the universe and begin to understand what sacrifice is about, as we talked about it. And at that point, all of these things start to mean something different. And they become no longer these kind of heavy moralistic things that are laid upon you. They become, of course. I mean, of course. You know? Like, doesn't everybody? You know, it's that kind of thing. Not, well, I'll do it or hell will break loose, but doesn't everybody? Now, the system that we're going to look at for a moment is the purification aspects in the Hindu tradition of what's called Raja Yoga or Ashtanga Yoga, eight-limbed Ashtanga, eight-limbed yoga, which was enunciated out of much earlier yogic stuff by Patanjali. And we're just going to consider in a little detail the first two limbs. This is all part of what the Gita talks about when it's dealing with the issues of renunciation. But this is the general stuff. For example, my guru said about Hatha Yoga. He said, nobody does Hatha Yoga anymore. And I said, no? He said, it's big in America, Maharaja. He says, no, nobody does it anymore because it assumes that you've already finished with the first two limbs of Ashtanga Yoga, which are called Yama, meaning death, Yama and Niyama, which we're going to talk about, which are the purification aspects. And nobody now does that, any of that stuff. And when you read Patanjali, there's a very beautiful exegesis. There are two nice ones of Patanjali's Raja Yoga. One is by Pravananda and Christopher Isherwood called How to Know God. It's a little small book. And the other one is Vivekananda's book called Raja Yoga. And both of them enunciated very clearly. And it's a very simple, tight series of steps you go through to get your game together. And the eight limbs of the yoga, if you would like them just to get an overall picture of the way a total yoga system works, called Raja or Kingly Yoga, is there a Yama and Niyama, which we're going to talk about in a minute, which are the purifications and the observances. Then there's Asanas, which is Hatha Yoga, and Pranayama, which is breath, part of Hatha Yoga. Then there's Pratyahara, which is the first stage of the meditative work that you've been doing, which is starting to withdraw the mind from the senses. It's bringing the mind back from the senses so you can watch your senses doing their trip and keep your mind on your breath. That was Pratyahara. And then following that are three more intense levels of deeper and deeper meditation called Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi. Takes you through the whole stage. And these orderings are not random. The first things precede the last things. That is, until you've done a certain amount of purification, as I've said before, you can't concentrate. If you've just stolen a book at the corner, a book on meditation, okay, and you run and you sit down and meditate, and there is a little doubt as to whether somebody saw you, okay, it's interesting. That's going to cost you something. It's not free. It's not quite free. That's part of what the predicament is about purifications. In Yama, the categories are non-killing, ahimsa, non-stealing. There are five of them in this first category. In Yama, non-killing, non-stealing, non-lying, brahmacharya, and non-giving and receiving, right? Those are the first five nons. Let's just for a moment look at a couple of these. Take non-killing, which is one we've been flirting with and I've been sort of sidestepping very delicately, especially since the Gita is all about war. Non-killing, it says, that's an assumption of this game. Non-killing, ahimsa, being non-violent. I'd like to quote, since Gandhi is the chief one that's usually related to nonviolence, and he worked on the Gita and lived by the Gita for his whole life, one might raise the question of the paradoxical nature of this. And what Gandhi said was, I mentioned it once before, but let me quote it directly now. If the Gita believed in ahimsa, or it was included in desirelessness, why did the author take a warlike illustration? When the Gita was written, although people believed in ahimsa, wars were not only not taboo, but nobody observed the contradiction between war and ahimsa. And you just have to stretch to figure out how that could possibly be. Then he goes on to say, let it be granted that according to the letter of the Gita, it is possible to say that warfare is consistent with renunciation of the fruit. But after 40 years' unremitting endeavor fully to enforce the teachings of the Gita in my own life, I have in all humility felt that perfect renunciation is impossible without perfect observance of ahimsa in every shape and form. Okay? In other words, Gandhi is taking exception now to the Gita, whether or not you can perform a violent act without breaking the ahimsa or nonviolence, whether a nonviolent person could ever perform a violent act. That's what the issue is. Now, Patanjali, in talking about ahimsa, it's the same thing as my teacher Haridas. Once when he was teaching me about ahimsa, he wrote on his slate, "Snakes know heart," K-N-O-W, "snakes know heart." He was talking about all the vicious snakes that were in the jungle. And I said, "Ooh," you know. He says, "Don't worry, snakes know heart," which didn't help matters any from my point of view. But what the point was, that it's this, and I think that's the whole image of St. Francis and the animals lying down together and so on, that in the presence of a being that is totally nonviolent in makeup, there is no vibration you're putting out which freaks another entity which is vibrationally oriented. Now, we've gotten all so gross, we don't even, most of the time, attend to vibrations between people. But animals do, and babies do. You know, you can walk into a room where there's a baby, and you can be all, everybody, all the adults can think you're a real groove. Eh? You walk in, the baby looks at you, wah! You know? And suddenly you realize your head wasn't in a cool place. Because they'll tell you they're just perfect thermometers, unless they have dysentery or something like that. Now, there are some interesting issues that we have to face. For example, I was for a long time vegetarian, which seemed like a nice ahimsa type thing to be. I did take milk. And I was up about a year ago, I was vegetarian at that time, I was up visiting Ken Kesey. Some of you may know he's a writer. And at his farm in Oregon. And Ken knew I was vegetarian. See? Ken, of course, isn't. And being the prankster that he is, he said, "Come on out, let me show you around." So he took me and he showed me the dairy cows and the whole scene. I was, oh, beautiful, and the gardens, isn't that beautiful? And then he showed me these two huge bulls. And I said, "What are you doing with them?" He says, "Well, we're fattening them up to eat them." You know? And I tried very hard to, you know, like, we had just been eating and smoking and blip, and so I was like being cool. And I said, "Oh, right, yeah." And he knew he was getting to me, see. I said, "You're just going to fatten them up, and when are you going to eat them?" He says, "Oh, in a few months." And he's patting them, you know, and he's hitting them on the head. And he says, "This one will really be good. There's really good steaks." And he's pointing right here where the steaks are. See? And I'm looking into the eyes of the animal and, you know, sending love messages. Then he looks at me, he says, "You know," he says, "if you want milk, you got to have bulls." And I suddenly saw the, not being a farm boy, I saw the reality of the predicament. To keep a cow giving milk, it has to be fertilized, and out of every time it's fertilized, half of the things that are born are bulls. What are you going to do with them? Just, you could feed them until they died a natural death. Like, I wore sandals for a long time that came from the Gandhi ashram, and they have a little stamp on them that said, "These came from the Gandhi ashram," which means that they only used cows that fell over dead in the streets. So it's not like they killed the cow to get the sandal. The cow died a natural death. So yogis can wear those sandals. Right? It seems a little bit, but, you know. But now we have all this other new information now about what plants go through when you bring a knife near them. See? So the diet's getting a little thin, isn't it? Okay. And I can imagine, I'm just remembering Schweitzer when he's walking down the path and stepping so he doesn't step on the ants. And how delicate the whole business is. I mean, if you walk into the jungle and you're wearing good leather boots to protect you from the thorns, and that leather came from an animal that died violently in order to produce those boots, you can assume that probably some of the chemistry of all the adrenaline must be still in the boots. And don't you think a wild animal that's around is going to know that? And you're walking on his brother, you know? And the brother's saying, watch out, yeah! You know, it's sending out all this stuff. It's like talking to a policeman when you're not holding dope, you know? It's the same place, you know? It's just a different space you're in, depending on whether you're holding or not holding. I'm sorry, that's a very precious example, only useful to a few of you. This is a drinking crowd, Each to his own, each to his own. Each to his own yoga. It seems to me, I mean, where I'm at the moment, I don't know where you should be at, but all I can share is in dealing with this predicament of ahimsa, that you do whatever you do as consciously as you can do it. Maybe I've talked already about, I think I did when I was at Esalen, and I used to meditate, and I had the cat that would bring in the mice and eat them, you know, crunch on the skull while I was meditating. You know, and bring it right between my legs because it loved me. And who should I hate? You know, it's not ahimsa. But the cat's just really being a cat. You know? And in a way, you can't deny any part of your karmic incarnation. And part of your incarnation is that you happen to be a being in a physical body. And that has certain survival things built into it. Now, at different stages of your yoga, your diet will keep changing. And at certain times, when you are still caught very much in very much worldly thought and heaviness, your diet, you will need just what the World Health Organization says you need. You need a certain amount of protein and a certain amount of carbohydrates, and you need vitamins, and you need all this kind of stuff. Later, as you get lighter and lighter and quieter and get deeper and more connected to a different space in the universe, and you start to be able to work with another kind of energy, and your diet changes, and that diet seems too heavy, and you start to eat, say, grains and fruits and vegetables and dairy products, and then maybe the dairy products start to get too heavy, and the grains start to get too heavy, and you're down to vegetables and fruits and nuts, and then maybe it gets that the vegetables are too heavy, and you become a fruitarian. Now, if you try at this moment, when you've just been had a hamburger yesterday, to become a fruitarian, you'll probably get really sick. But were you ready, fruitarianism would be the most natural thing, and anything else would feel gross. Okay? And if you keep going, then you get so you just live on light. Yeah. Like Teresa Neumann had one Eucharist wafer a day as a hype. You know, just sort of a put-on. For 12 years, she just ate one Eucharist wafer a day, and she was a good Zaftig woman. I mean, she wasn't, you know. And they said, what are you living on? She said, I'm living on light. Because it's all, I mean, it's chlorophyll, sun, energy transformations. Energy is energy. What you can process as energy depends on which receptors are open in you. That's what the whole purification trip is about. So that you can start to work with all the energies. You can get so clear that not only can you start to work with light and with this, but you can take any vibration that comes at you and convert it and use it. So if somebody comes up to you and says, I hate you and rah, kill, rah, rah, that's all energy. It's yours if you want it, if you know how to use it. If you get freaked in the form it came in, if you can't repackage it, well, that's your problem. But if you are a transmuting vehicle, you can take any energies and get off on them. Huh? And the predicament about nonviolence is that until we are really clear, meaning quiet enough to be hearing how it all is, everything we do is coming out of our own desire systems, and that's the horror of being in a limited perspective. But yet, at the point you're at, you've got to do the best you can, and I do the best I can by trying to be as nonviolent as I can be. I try to kill as few things or to create the conditions as minimally as possible that would demand that things be raised and be killed in order to service my existence. But the thing, for example, in talking about diet, which let me just work with a little more, like chickens, for example. I stopped eating meat, fish, chicken, and eggs some years back. And then I got into the predicament where I thought, you know, I think maybe I'm being phony. So I better go back and eat it all again. I told you about the spare ribs. Right. Didn't I tell you about the spare ribs? I didn't tell you about the spare ribs. Well, I guess I told a group in the other room. What happened was, when I finally decided, I was a 7-year vegetarian, see? It's like you have, you know, like in the bus company, they have how many years of service you're in. And I was slightly obnoxiously superior about, you know, because I was a vegetarian back when, you know, I was being quoted on Macrobiotics in 1964, you know, saying it gets you high. So I decided there was a place in me where I was caught in what you will begin to see is what's known as the sattvic trap. I was caught in being a good guy, and I ought to sort of undercut it. So what I better do is break my vegetarian trip just to break it. And since I was raised as a Jew, I might as well really do the trip up so I would have spare ribs, which would hit it from both angles, right? So I found a Chinese restaurant. I went there in the middle of the afternoon. It was one of those dark ones that, you know. And I was on the road to New Hampshire, and I went in and I ordered the spare ribs, and I blessed them. I gave a particularly long blessing, offering them. I said to Maharaji, I know you think this is strange, but it's the way it is, and you know my heart, and you know why I'm doing it, and I'm just going to do it, you know. And then I proceeded to thoroughly enjoy the spare ribs. I mean, they were as good as I had remembered them being. And I had just finished, and there was a man sitting at about 2 booths away in a suit and a tie and gold wristwatch, and he was drinking tea through my whole meal, and he was watching me, and finally he came over and he said, may I sit down for a minute? Sure. He said, I'm a traveling salesman for an electronics outfit at MIT. And he said, you know, I couldn't help watching how you bless the food, and it was, the blessing was so powerful I haven't been able to leave the restaurant. And it turned out that he was a fundamentalist Christian, and we got into a beautiful rap about the Bible and Christ, and we talked for about an hour and a half and drank a lot of tea. And finally he said, I'm just so delighted to have met you, and it's wonderful and all. He said, you know, I've had a lot of trouble with my diet. What do you eat? Hey. And I looked down, and right in front of me with this pile of bones, you know. You're looking at it, you know. I would have done anything to be able to push it away. Well, I'm a vegetarian. I was like, and I had to face the fact that, like when I was in India, I had been vegetarian for a long time, and we stayed at this hotel called the Palace Heights, and it's the hippie hangout in Kano Circus. And it turned out that the window in the room we were on overlooked the alley next to a fancy restaurant, and the Indians are going Western these days in Delhi. And at that restaurant, they serve chicken. And out in the alley, they wring the necks of the chickens, see, in the afternoon, every afternoon around 4. And we'd come back from shopping and be lying there, and suddenly, you know, and it would be, and I felt all my chicken karma. You know, all the Sunday chicken dinners I was paying for, you know, like there was another one and there was another one. And but it's interesting, recently I've gone to Colonel Sanders, okay, knowing the horror of it all. I mean, not only the physical horror of the way the chickens are produced, but the absurdity that I'm asking them to produce the chicken so I can eat it. Sit with that horror, because I can't be phony holy anymore. I've just got to be where I'm at. And I don't really want to eat the chicken, but there I am eating the chicken. Now that's a form of yoga I'm talking about now, that we're going to talk about a little more, which gets into the realm of what's called tantra, as opposed to renunciation. You renounce the chicken in one sense, and in the other one, you eat the chicken consciously. And the question of which ends, which is easier on the chickens in the long run, is an open question. Because in pushing away chickens, you may end up being so violent, so frustrated with such rich sadistic fantasies because of premature pushing away of chickens, okay, that you go out and really destroy everybody around you psychologically, create incredible suffering just because you didn't eat that last chicken. I mean, I'm not giving you that as a practical suggestion. I'm just sharing with you the psychological dilemma you have to face about when you renounce and when you don't renounce. And it's what's known as the middle path that we're going to be talking about, the middle way. I'm not going to go through all of them in great length, but let me just work with truthfulness just a little bit too. A woman once came to Mahatma Gandhi with her little boy. She said, "Mahatmaji, tell my little boy to stop eating sugar." "Come back in 3 days," said Gandhi. In 3 days, the woman and the little boy returned, and Mahatma Gandhi said to the little boy, "Stop eating sugar." The woman asked, "Why was it necessary for us to return only after 3 days for you to tell my little boy that?" Mahatmaji replied, "3 days ago, I had not stopped eating sugar." Now, there is a very far-out thing about truth, that when you are rooted in truth, really rooted in truth, your word takes on a power. This is exactly what powers are about, where when you give someone a blessing, the blessing is given, it happens. And when you say, "Be healed," the person is healed. That's the power of the word. And the word comes out of that place of truth. It comes out of a place where you are so connected inward to deeper and deeper levels of truth that everything comes out of you is straight at every level. Now, at this point, we don't have a deep enough connection to be straight at every level, so we start being straight where we can be. And I told you, or maybe I didn't, the Mahatma Gandhi story about him leading the march and then stopping it after a day, and people getting upset because he stopped it. And he said, "My commitment is to truth, not to consistency. And I don't know absolute truth, only God is that. I only know relative truth, and each day it changes. So I can only be consistent with the truth as I see it from day to day. And it may seem inconsistent to you, but that's your problem. You've got to work with it. Because I've got to be truthful, even though I have to reverse myself. And you'll find on the spiritual journey, you'll keep reversing yourself again and again. Because you'll think you're clear and you've come to a conclusion. That's why I say the Dharma, finding your Dharma, is like a floating crap game. It's like it's always moving its locale because it doesn't stay in one place. So you think you know what your root is, and then that turns out to be another hype. And you've just gotten all your new outfits and your brownie badges and your beads and your whole thing that goes with your new shtick. And then suddenly the whole thing is dead and empty and horrible. And what are you going to do? You know, you got to give them the Salvation Army and go on. Okay. And you get so you just rent them. You don't buy them because you see that you're going to go through these trips very, very quickly. And you can't cling too heavy.